What is it, Dad?
Sterling, call the police. Operator, call the police. Send them up here immediately.
Never mind the police. I'll take care of this situation. Listen, Fishcake. I mean, Catfish. Where were you when this thing happened?
Well, with you.
Well, where was I when this happened?
You with him.
Oh, well, now we're going places. Where were you when this thing happened?
Never mind.
You wouldn't remember anyway. You know, a dilemma like this is enough to drive a man to drink.
What'll you have?
Scotch and soda. What do you mean, what'll I have?
Well, you said something about a drink.
Gentlemen, this is not getting us any place.
Well, the police will take care of that.
You know what I think?
What?
I think that magic man been here with that basket.
Oh, boom.
You'd better get your things packed. We're leaving here right away.
I'll hurry.
Will you boys step into my room? I'd like to speak to you a moment.
I bet we're going to be fired.
Why, we haven't done anything.
Maybe that's the reason we're going to be fired.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And those dulcet tunes, as anyone knows who listens to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, belong to Michael H. Price, my co-host and co-conspirator. Michael, it's good to be with you again.
Way too long between sessions. That's
it does seem like it.
We keep it on the agenda. Hell, if we could get away with it weekly, I think we would.
That's right, but you know, sometimes less is more, too. You know, right? So there you go. Well, we heard from Chris Mounts, one of our listeners, and we really appreciate that. And you know, we've asked if anybody wants us to do to talk about a movie, that we're always glad to do that. And Chris wanted us to talk about a film called Mummy's Boys with a, I would say, fairly well-forgotten comedy team from the 30s, a little bit into the 20s, named Wheeler and Woolsey. And I still want to know from Chris Mounts, Chris, if you're listening, if you are any relation at all to Bill Mounts, because Michael and I are both Western Swing fans, and there was a guy named Bill Mounts who was a big figure in Western Swing, who actually had a band called Sons of the South and cut some stuff for RCA Bluebird. And so if you're not, that's fine. Just ignore us. And Mounts is probably a usual enough name that it's probably no kin, as we say here in Oklahoma. But be that as it may, let's get to Mummy's Boys from 1936, a Depression-era picture with Burt Wheeler, the wavy-haired one, and also Woolsey, who was reminds you now of George Burns, doesn't he? He had the bespectacled look. He has the big cigar that he uses as a prop. Very much in what we would consider the George Burns tradition. I suspect Burns had it before Woolsey did, didn't he?
I'm sure, yes. Wheeler and Woolsey were unique. Many consider them also rans to the Marxes, and of course they were precursors of Abbott and Costello.
Right.
They really didn't imitate so much as they just pulled a really weird shtick, you know.
It was a weird shtick because it's not, you know, Joey and I watched it together, our producer, Joey Hambrick, and Joey and I watched it together, and one of the things that's interesting, it's not really knockabout stuff, is it? I mean, there is a physical element to the comedy, but it's also sort of that vaudeville kind of snappy patter. It's a combination.
It's almost cerebral.
It almost is. You're absolutely right. Yeah, it almost is.
It's kind of slapstick for eggheads.
Yeah, I guess that's true. That's a good way to put it. And but it's by this time, Wheeler and Woolsey were on the downhill slide. As a matter of fact, a couple of years after this film, Mummy's Boys, Robert Woolsey died. He had a kidney disease that was chronic, and he passed away at the age of 49 in 1938. I think it's interesting. I looked up some just ephemeral kinds of things, but in 1936, press release came out that said that Robert Woolsey had smoked, let's see if I've got my notes here, he had used 20,000 cigars in his film career. Now that, so if you put, and the press release further said, if you put the cigars in a line, they would stretch from Hollywood to Chicago.
Whoa!
So there you go. Apparently, from what I can tell, he picked it up kind of like George Burns as a prop because he needed something to do with his hands.
Yeah.
But that was in 1936. That press release came out from RKO Pictures, the home of Wheeler and Woolsey, at the same time that Mummy's Boys came out. And one of the things I've been thinking about on this, Michael, is we've got – everybody thinks about Abbott Costello Meet the Mummy. Then there's the Three Stooges, right, where you've got, what, Mummy's Dummies, where they've got King Rootin' Tootin' and the Smiling Egyptians use chariot lot. But it's – how do you think it holds up as one of those comedy just-add monsters, and we'll get into that in a minute, but one of those just-add monsters mummy movies, how do you think it stands up?
I think it stands up pretty well with the chronic fascination with ancient Egypt, or as we call it in the comic books, anxious Egypt.
Right.
It really holds up a lot better than Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy.
Yes, even though there's a real mummy, not to give too much away, but there's a real mummy in Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy.
Yes, exactly. It's one of those kind of. It's a combination of a Shaggy Dog story with elements of a classic old Hollywood monster movie, and it's got that the mummy is almost a red herring.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
That is a screen presence, person, creature, whatever that looks too guilty to be the real bad guy.
Right, right, exactly. Yes, that's exactly right. And it's not, again, it's not, I mean, I don't think we're giving too much away to say it's not a real mummy. But one of the things I also, in addition to what you're talking about with those elements, there's also, in the very first part of it, a real Depression era element to it. When they're digging, Wheeler and Woolsey are basically ditch diggers who get fired because they're just not very good at it and really don't care, and are sort of silently protesting their lot in life, which is twisted around when they come in and to Egypt, when they get a job working on the expedition. And you remember that scene where they go in and they say, "We wish to purchase some of your more expensive things." And I think that's a really interesting part of it. And I know you're a big Van Ten Moreland guy too, but you know Willie Best does a great job here.
Willie Best and Van Ten Moreland and Eddie Anderson or Rochester,
yes,
were considered by the Hollywood trade papers to be the top three black players working mm-hmm. in that period.
Comedic or just in general?
Well, there really weren't there weren't any black leading men or leading ladies
true,
to speak of,
true.
With certain conspicuous exceptions like Lena Horne.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Robeson kind of wrecked his own Hollywood career by embracing the Soviet
right.
philosophy, and he got blacklisted before there was a blacklist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is a banishment from the Hollywood establishment. So, yes, the top three or four, however many, black players in Hollywood would have been comedians.
Mm-hmm.
And quite
mm-hmm.
frequently they played to stereotype in order to, not to assimilate, but in order to keep working.
Right, right.
Mantan was defiant of his second-class citizenship. You get that attitude in his performances, even though he might be playing a valet or a chauffeur. Willie Best was usually the sidekick to the white guy leading personality, and invariably upstaged whoever that might be.
Just as Mantan Moreland did in his monogram stuff.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. And you keep, even in those bigger studio pictures where, for example, Mantan would be the valet to the private detective or some such.
Right.
And might not have a very largely written part, you would see how flat the movie fell when Mantan was off screen.
And you would also see in those monogram pictures, of course, which Mantan, as you pointed out, and we should plug now, although we usually plug at the end of the show, but we should plug your book, Mantan the Funny Man, which I learned a lot about Mantan Moreland. Very, very good, very good reading, Mantan the Funny Man, which is available, I feel sure, still on Amazon.com. But in it, you know, Mantan, I found out Mantan had a double contract with Monogram. He wrote the scenes he was in as well as acting in them. And, of course, he had the Monogram Ranch out in Watts, I remember, that he said.
But was a kind of an ironic name he gave it, of course. But his palatial digs, his high-class apartments, I think he named one of them Monogram Ranch because that's how he financed it.
Right, exactly. And you see the things that he did with Frankie Darrow for Monogram. We've talked about these before, I believe, on this podcast. Things like Up in the Air, that radio, the wonderful little compact vest pocket murder mystery. And they are absolute equals in those pictures.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that my favorite. We are digressing as
we
usual.
We are digressing
my favorite, as usual. My favorite Mantan line from Up in the Air is when he and Frankie are getting ready to do a comedy routine in hopes of getting a radio show of their own, and Mantan turns to Frankie and says, "You don't expect me to speak in no dialect now, do you?"
That's right. Well, Willie Best and I. Well, we have to put Step and Fetch It in there as well.
He was kind of a star apart. Mm-hmm. He wasn't all that prolific during the period where Willie Best and Mantan Moreland and of course Rochester thrived.
A little earlier, I guess, huh?
He was more royalty from the stage, slumming in the movies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And of course, Lincoln Perry, Step and Fetch It, did succumb to over stereotyping, and it was largely his own doing. Mm-hmm. I've got copies of his correspondence to, like, the stage manager at a theater where he would be performing. And, boy, they sound like they were written by a professor of English.
Now, were they black theaters or were these white theaters he was performing in?
It varied. He was on Broadway a lot, but
yes.
He also played the Apollo Theater.
So was he ever with that Lafayette bunch in New York?
Lafayette players? I believe so.
Mm-hmm. That's what I thought, yeah.
And, of course, Step and Fetch It made some really low-budget stuff for the black ensemble picture makers.
Like Sack and those guys?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Like Audie, like pictures that ended up in the collection that I helped archive at Southern Methodist University called the Tyler, Texas Black Film Collection.
The films that were for black audiences.
Right, yeah. Of course, Step and Fetch It had a prominent role in another ancient Egyptian curse movie called Charlie Chan in Egypt.
Right, exactly. That's a little earlier than this, is it? Or is it about the same? Yeah, a little earlier.
I'd have to look up the exact year, but it is earlier.
Well, see, we're from Rogers County, of course, named after Will Rogers' father, Clem. And, you know, Step and Fetch It was a fixture in so many of the Will Rogers pictures, which, honestly, for a lot of people, make them hard to watch today for some.
Yeah, you got to appreciate the beginnings of a tendency to let players of color interpret themselves on the screen.
That's right.
Because so many silent pictures had portrayed black characters using white actors in blackface.
Right. And then, of course, we talk about digressing now, but and then 1915 came along. What, after 1915, there were over 100 film companies, both black and white, most of them, of course, small, but both run by African-Americans and by Caucasians, and came along because, of course, of the stereotype that came along the Klansman, and I just lost the title of the movie, Birth of a Nation. Thank you. Yeah, based on the book The Klansman, and all of a sudden the people found out that there was a market for movies that portrayed black people not as they'd been portrayed in Birth of a Nation, which was pretty awful, and so there were a lot of companies that came along, and that was 1915. And then 20 years later, somehow this all shook out, and we have, Willie Best and Mantan Moreland and, Snowflake, Toombs, and all of those characters, but are mostly playing comedic roles.
Right, right. That's a pretty sorry pattern overall, but...
Yeah, it is.
They played their best.
Yep.
Not to make a pun on Willie's name, but,
right.
In fact, Bob Hope pointed that out to me when we did the career interview spanning, 1979 through about, 81, I think it was.
Yes.
Did a long series of interviews with Bob Hope, and he kept bringing up Willie Best as his favorite sidekick.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah, he said, he's the best actor I've ever worked with, and I'm not making a play on words.
Hmm. And he would compare him to Bing, put him in the same league as Bing Crosby?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow, that's excellent. That's great.
Of course, Crosby and Hope never really acted together.
No.
They acted up together.
Yeah, they acted. That's exactly right. That's a good way to put it. Very good way to put it. Well, and the thing about Willie Best, he's always great to watch, and he's great to watch in this picture. I don't know, for years I thought there are a couple of things I remember that seeing as a monster kid in the late 50s or early 60s that came back with this. I thought they were in a Universal picture. I thought they were in one of the Mummy movies, and I never saw it, but it's the thing where they talk about Willie Best being from Cairo, and then he says he doesn't know where they are. He says, yeah, I'm from Cairo, Illinois. And I remember that from when I was a kid, and I remember also on one of the characters' arms, is either Wheeler or Woolsey, where they have the dancing girl. And for years, I'll bet you, Michael, for 60 years, I thought that came from some Universal picture, and it's not. I saw it somewhere. I couldn't have seen it on Shock Theater because it was an RKO picture. But I saw it somewhere on late night TV and got it in my head, got it all mixed up with the Universal monster movies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, RKO's style was distinct from Universal, but they had a lot in common.
They did. They absolutely did.
And, in fact, RKO licensed its Depression and wartime films to television about the same time as Shock Theater.
And perhaps that's how that all happened. I wouldn't be a bit surprised if Shock Theater or one of the stations that showed Shock Theater would have bought other packages. And
well, sometimes they mixed them up. The local programmers had the final say so.
Right, right.
I remember a tremendous disappointment as a kid when one of the local stations had announced, oh, let me see, I Walked with a Zombie,
mm-hmm.
Another RKO from the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, I'm all set for this. I'd read about it in the Monster Kid magazines.
Right.
And time comes and the RKO logo shows up. So wait a minute, that's a later RKO logo type at the front. And they showed instead Zombies on Broadway. another comedy team picture where they just added monsters.
Alan Carney and Wally Brown. And
yeah.
we should say that when we talk about just add monsters, you and I have written about this in the Forgotten Horrors series and long had the theory that when a comedy team or a genre like the biker picture is starting to fall off a little bit and lose a little bit of the bloom off the rose, then the filmmakers just add monsters. and worked, obviously, Abbott and Costello is make a perfect example, but also, I mean, you look at like the biker pictures and Werewolves on Wheels, and you know, you look at any film trend or a comedy team, and indeed, Mummy's Boys came along toward the end of Wheeler and Woolsey's reign. I mean, they only made a couple of pictures after Mummy's Boys.
Yeah, they set a standard that was induplicable. There was a lot of Marx Brothers in Wheeler and Woolsey. There was a lot of Chaplin-esque grace in Wheeler and Woolsey.
Right.
But they were unique, and they were wordplay more than slapstick.
They were, absolutely. And, you know, I'm wondering, Michael, you watched that picture, which you can actually get on YouTube, and you watched that picture, and it's got some big trappings, and I'm wondering what kind of sets were recycled from RKO. Do you have any idea about that?
I haven't examined it closely for identifying architecture or geography, but it is, I believe there's an element, a scenic element from The Most Dangerous Game. I believe scenic elements left over from some of the Pathé lot relics, like the Cecil B. DeMille silent epics that, you know, RKO Pathé kept things standing. That's how the, I mean, the native village, for example, in King Kong had been redressed from an epic of earlier times. And the scene dock at RKO, man, they kept that not in addition to the standing sets, they kept a scene dock in operation that contained props and architectural elements from many pictures. And they would just, you know, trot those things out. That's why the Val Lewton pictures look so big.
Right, right. And they were actually very small pictures.
Yes,
this was probably good. A small picture, too, was it not?
It's an RKOB.
Yeah.
It's one of those productions. Of course, the term B movie didn't come into industry usage until the 40s, but they were making B movies, B as in budget, not as in a grading system. Way back when, so many of the Universals in that later Depression era period would have been B movies.
You mean the horror movies or just the Universals in general?
Well, Universals as a class, especially after the buyout in 1936, when it became the new Universal and the founding family had been removed.
The Limleys, you mean?
Yeah, the Limley family. B movies abound even before there was a popular term for them.
Right, right. And I've also thought that B movies, a lot of times that refers to the second feature, because so many studios would do that. You know, you'd have the A picture, and then you'd kind of slip a little B movie in underneath it. But then again, in some circumstances, and especially in this part of the country, and small theaters around in the middle of the country might show all B movies. And of course, that's what Sam Arkoff. That's what was his brilliant thing to do when he started up American Releasing, became American International Pictures with James Nicholson. They would basically send out a double feature of two B movies instead of an A and a B. Am I getting that right? I mean, that seems to
That's
me.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah.
That was a purposeful strategy.
Right, right. And it wouldn't have happened, of course, without the antitrust suit in 1947 when the government made the major studios, the five major studios that own their own theaters, get rid of their theaters because of the idea, and also get rid of block booking. You couldn't sell them. You couldn't say you're going to have to take 10 B pictures for these two Clark Gable pictures. And, with theaters that they didn't own. And so it was basically an antitrust suit, I guess, at its.
Of course, the antitrust winds blow hot and cold and in various directions. That's where the big Southern Interstate Theater circuit came from. Was the remnants of what had been Paramount Picture Theaters.
Oh, okay. I did not know that. What part of the country? Just throughout our part of the country, through the south and the west?
All over. Paramount had, it was called Paramount Publix Corp. that had the theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And when Paramount Publix became defunct, that is when the big studio was forced to divest, regional operators, theatrical companies, bought those theaters.
Mm-hmm.
In Texas and a lot of the general south by southwest, they became interstate theaters.
I see. Okay. Well, and there you go. And we've once again digressed. So we move back to Wheeler and Woolsey, and just a little background on Wheeler and Woolsey. They were never really critical favorites, like Laurel and Hardy and like a lot of other people, but they were making pictures from the late 20s on. And what happened, they were both individual comics until Ziegfeld put them together for, I believe it was Ziegfeld, for Rio Rita on stage.
Rio Rita.
Mm-hmm, in 28.
On Broadway.
That was the first appearance that Wheeler and Woolsey had together. And then they made a film of Rio Rita, I believe was released in 29. RKO had it. And that's what took them off. And, you know, it's hard to see. I mean, I think it's hard to see. It's maybe it's not hard to see so much as you just don't think about looking for them. But there's, I don't know how many Wheeler and Woolsey pictures are out there now that you can watch.
That's why we recommend frequently the use of imdb.com.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that lets you know the titles, and that gives you the titles from which to research the whereabouts. And surprisingly, large numbers are available on YouTube and on budget label DVDs.
Oh, that's wonderful. I think anybody who wants to, there are better Wheeler and Woolsey pictures than Mummy's Boys, I think. I think Half Shot at Sunrise is one of my favorites. I really like that picture.
Crack Nuts is a favorite,
yeah. But is it Dorothy Lee was their leading lady most of the time? Was that her name?
Yes.
And not in this picture, not in Mummy's Boys. It's Barbara Pepper, who was a really interesting actress, because I remember her being a pretty tough, one of those tough dame types in the 30s. You know,
she was kind of the Sally Struthers before Sally Struthers.
Right.
Much so. Real wisecracking, streetwise type. Had many generations of fans. Toward the end of her career, I think it was on Green Acres.
She was with Arnold Ziffel. She was Mrs. Ziffel, if I remember. Doris Ziffel, I think, was her name. Jeez. Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of people will remember as that. But, you know, she was hardboiled. She was kind of a Joan Blondell type. She always struck me as that. She also did a lot of just hardboiled, and she was all over the place, and mostly B pictures, but some A pictures. But in this, she is not hardboiled at all. She's just kind of an ingenue. And I think that's really an interesting portrayal of her.
Well, she had that air of innocence about her. She could radiate all manner of attitudes. Her famous saying went along the lines of, millionaires like to get their money worth, and us showgirls know how to make them think they're getting it.
Well, there you go.
She's the featured player with Wally Ford in one of the pivotal Forgotten Horrors pictures, that being The Rogue's Tavern.
Yes.
From the same year as Mummy's Boys.
That's right. And that's a really scary little picture, too.
Oh, yeah. Especially when you realize that the perceived culprit, a wolf dog, mm-hmm. one of the funniest lines in the picture, and yet it's also pretty creepy, where Wally Ford realizes that, how did he put it, whoever killed those people used a false set of dog teeth.
I love Wallace Ford.
Oh, man. I mean, that is creepy and funny at the same time.
Yes, absolutely.
And it turns out that he's right.
Yeah. That's true. That's right. When they have the mad scene and that, and we find out who really did it. I think we could recommend, this is a pretty painless way to spend a little over an hour, isn't it? I mean, if you want to see Wheeler and Woolsey, there are better Wheeler and Woolsey pictures. But if you like Wheeler and Woolsey with added monsters, this is pretty much the one to go for, isn't it?
Wheeler and Woolsey are an acquired taste.
They are. They absolutely
but
are.
But once you've acquired the taste, you want more.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Well, Michael, speaking of wanting more, this is the portion of the show where we'd like to talk about maybe, and this is originally coming out around Christmas time, and if folks maybe want to be looking at buying books for themselves or others, or you can get books, or you can actually get the downloads, either one, and a lot of the books you've got out there. What's out there right now that you would you'd like to talk about?
Well, the latest, which is from an outside publisher that I've been dealing with, is an expanded edition of George Turner's The Making of King Kong, speaking of our KO radio.
Right, right.
And that was my apprenticeship in 1968, helping George Turner do the research for that book, and then I was granted control of his intellectual properties after he died, and promptly put out a fairly well-revised edition, and finally, this new one is what I consider to be the definitive Making of King Kong. It restores George's original manuscript with everything that he and I had learned in the years since then.
And of course, I'm still
learning things about King Kong. You know?
Who did it come out from? Who's the book? Who published the book?
It's Pulp Hero.
Oh, Press. Yes. I know Pulp Hero Press. Yeah. Yeah. Very good.
They're an affiliate of Theme Park Press, which does the Disney memoir books.
Right, right. Excellent. What else you got out there? I know we got that big Deep in the Horrors of Texas Volume 2.
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty big on that one. Yeah, I think I'm going to do a Volume 3. It's going over pretty well. Of course, our collaborative book, Fantasies in the Sand, is one of those books that we wrote because we wanted to read a book like that.
Exactly. Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, and not to take anything away from the existing beach party histories.
And there's some great ones out there.
Which,
we
many
talk
of
about
which
them,
were influential on what we have done here.
Absolutely.
But I think we take it in a unique direction.
Well, I think just taking it back to the 1940s and the 1930s and the Wild Women and the Guna Guna pictures and then the Sarong pictures of World War II and casting it in that context, I think.
And then taking them all back to Paul Gauguin.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely.
Tropical exotic romance filtered through American International Pictures gave us Beach Party.
Right.
In 1963, mm-hmm. which is consistent with those exotic romance movies, but it's somehow more innocent.
Yes, yes, that's a good way to put it. But it couldn't have come without those other movies, probably, or wouldn't
the influence. Well, I mean, it was your masterstroke to note the the sound-alike resonance between the names Annette and Aquanetta.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, it's like, okay, there's the final hook.
Right.
We need it.
Right.
Quick.
Right. And I was so glad to be able to do a lot of research on Aquanetta's career, too, because that was just... And you know, the without giving away too much, the book is certainly available. And actually, it's been doing pretty well, and we're pretty excited about that. But
yeah.
Not to give too much away, but Aquanetta had quite a life after she left the movies, too. And
she always struck me as forbidding and like exotic in a kind of an intimidating way.
Yes, yes.
The role she was given, the jealous artist's model in Dead Men's Eyes with Lon Chaney Jr., the ape woman, Paula Dupre.
Jealous ape woman who is triggered
jealous
by jealousy.
Jealous ape woman and homicidally jealous.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And yet it turns out that she had one hell of a sense of humor.
She apparently did, didn't she?
And knew how to work the publicity system to make herself appear either more or less exotic than she really was.
That's right.
Fascinating personality. And then toward the end of her career and the end of her life, a kind of a provincial celebrity outside the Hollywood system.
That's right. Who had her own dolls that her car salesman husband would give away with Lincolns that were sold, and autographed pictures of Aquanetta. It's a pretty interesting story. It's a real interesting story, and we'd like for folks to check that out if they're so inclined. And Michael, I have to tell you, just this past week, we're doing this in early December. Or mid-December. And just this past week, I've had a new book come out that I'm very excited about. I wrote with my friend Robert A. Brown, and it's called Seventh Sense. It's the first of a trilogy that we're doing, and it's a horror novel, all epistolary, completely told by letter, set in 1939, with a guy with the WPA Folklore Project getting up in the Arkansas Mountains, the Ozarks, and finding a big nest of witches. And so far, we're getting really good reviews. We're getting really good sales on it. And anybody who likes horror novels, I'd like to suggest that you take a look at that one. That's a pretty soft sell, I think.
That's as fine a story as I've read in its class. It reminds me, of course, of our friend Joe Lansdale.
Right, right.
The regionalism, of course, the regionalism was part of Lovecraft. I have likened your book to Lovecraft in many respects.
You have.
Even to the point of finding, here we go again with the sound-alike resonance, Arkham?
Macaville, Arkansas.
Arkham plus Arkansas.
Right.
What a concept, you know?
And then you also found Macaville and Machiavellian, I think, was the thing that you mentioned.
Yeah. Those things I'm very, very fond of epistolary narrative, that is, where letters and such things as, well, newspaper clippings, letters, transcribed conversations. You feel like there's almost a voyeuristic quality to that epistolary approach.
There absolutely is. I couldn't agree more. And this is the first time I've really taken this approach, and it really started because Robert, and as you know, sent me some letters on these old 1930s airmail envelopes and airmail stamps, and took on the persona of a character from the 1930s, and you know, I saw a novel there, I saw a book there, and I want to thank you again because you provided just the flap copy for that, and you said some very nice things about the book, and we're seeing some people now show up on Amazon and other places with some other nice reviews about the book. So thank you very much for that, and you know, we're coming up on a new year. I guess we're going to be doing some more stuff, huh?
I think we have no choice.
I don't think so either.
There's no way around it.
I'm going to throw this on you, and I meant to mention this before we went on, started recording, but I have an idea of a film that I would like to do for next time. It's a contemporary film. It's a little bit, it's 90s? I guess it's a 90s film.
I think it's early 90s.
Early 90s film. I would love to do Popcorn.
Oh, my gosh, what a treat that is.
I was sent by Fangoria Magazine to Midtown Kingston to cover that film when I was working with Fangoria. Of course, you and I did the Forgotten Horrors columns for Fangoria for so many years. But and I would really like to talk a little bit about that and see kind of what you think about it. I think it's a very underrated picture.
It's a picture for anyone who loves the exploitation movie scene.
Yes, yes.
And who is enchanted with, well, say, Joe Dante's movie Popcorn. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Joe Dante's movie with John Goodman. Matinee playing Bill Castle, William Castle.
That's right.
And it's just one of those fascinating. It's like a behind the scenes look at that sector of Hollywood. And Jill Shalen. What a great actress.
I have to say, I carried her bags, and we'll talk about this. I carried her bags into the hotel for her from the airport, and it was I was the one that dubbed her the Thinking Man's Scream Queen, Michael.
There you go.
And
yeah,
I think that's probably a pretty accurate thing. Wonderful young woman, and I haven't, of course, seen her. I know she retired from the screen and several years ago, but if you'd like to go over that next time, I'd like to put that up as our next conversational topic here on Forgotten
Horrors Podcast. Yes, I remember. In fact, I remember explicitly the press screening for Popcorn. I got so enchanted with watching the movie and so carried away with being in the moment of the movie that I swallowed a wad of bubble gum.
Right. Well, with that kind of pedigree behind it, with that kind of emotion we have, how can we miss on that one? So thank you very much, Michael. It's always great to visit, and we just want to thank everybody for listening. And if you enjoyed it, please check out our books, the Forgotten Horrors franchise, Michael's books, Michael's franchise, on Amazon.com or any other. There's other places, of course, where it is. And just all you have to do, I guess, is just look up our names on Amazon.com, and you can find more than you can say grace over. Thank you, Michael.
What a pleasure.
Happy holidays.
You too.